Greetings to all of you this morning in the lovely name of Jesus. So good to be here again this morning. I feel so encouraged, so excited, so strengthened in the Lord. It's good to know that He's on our side. We're on the winning team if we're His children. A welcome to all of you, those of you that are visitors this morning and those that have been gone, welcome back. Where to start? We've been going through the book of Hebrews, and we are camping out in chapter 11 right now. And I'm just curious if anyone can tell me what the title of my last message was from the book of Hebrews. Now you're cheating. It was only three words, just a hint. What was my subtitle? Okay, Trenton, maybe we have to have your help after all. What is faith? That was my subtitle for my last message. Today we continue in our series, Hebrews is an Encouragement to Believers, Part 21, The History of Faith. The History of Faith. So we're going to launch today into the examples that were given here in this chapter of those who've walked out their faith in the Old Testament. And I have to admit to you that this feels like a very overwhelming opportunity because of the vastness of the stories that are mentioned. We're only given a small snapshot of each character that's listed in this spiritual hall of fame, as it's so often called. So in order to do justice to this text, we should probably dedicate about 17, 18 messages going forward to this chapter. I actually counted through, and the individuals that are listed that have specific things mentioned about them, not talking about the latter ones where he gives the whole list of all of them, not to speak of Barak and Samson and David and all the others that he lists in that last line, I'm not even including those. We could have probably about 17 or 18 different messages that speak about faith, about from each individual and the lessons that we could learn from all of those. We won't be doing that today. We won't be doing that next time we preach. But I hope that you will continue looking forward to the series that Weldon is doing of the Old Testament story that might well cover some of these characters. So I hope that you can keep looking forward to those and learn from them as he goes through them. I don't expect that he'll cover necessarily all of the ones that are mentioned, but perhaps he will. Depends on how committed he is and how long he wants to make his series. Series can get very long, but I think it's very valuable for us to follow through with the continuity of Scripture. I think there's a very powerful thing that we can learn. We get the context, we get the setting, and we understand better what is going on at the time of the writing. Remember that all of Scripture is preserved for us to learn from. So we are left sometimes with a wonderment of how what happened when it was written, how that fits for us today. But as the Word of God is, like Johnny said in our Sunday school class this morning, often we read the story of John the Baptizer, which is actually probably a more correct term to identify him. We read it and it's just fact. It's just he was who he was. He said what he said. He did what he did. He was faithful to his calling. But we miss We miss so much truth if we don't dig in and look at it. And next Sunday, we could probably study the same text again and still not have enough time. And probably the next Sunday as well, and maybe a few more after that. That's the power of the written word. That's the power of the book of Hebrews. That's the power of the book of Romans. You could go through these books over and over and over again. Jim could follow up in a series in Rome and Hebrews immediately after I'm done and come with completely different messages. That's the power of the written word, and that's what I appreciate about it. So a lot of what we do comes from a personal style of study and presentation and so forth, and I'm sure you're aware of that. So today, my style simply is going to be to cover the rest of the chapter. I'm going to cover verses 4 through 40. So I invite you to turn to Hebrews chapter 11, and we're going to read this all the way through. So listen carefully. Beginning in verse 4, "By faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh. By faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and was not found, because God had translated him. For before his translation he had this testimony, that he pleased God. But without faith it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world, and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. By faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. By faith Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel, and gave commandment concerning his bones. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Other translations say edict. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Through faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians, essaying to do, were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were compassed about 7 days. By faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, not when she had received the spies with peace. And what shall I say more? And what shall I more say? For the time will fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. I could go sit down and it would be enough. Every time I read this chapter, I wonder about the complex question of what does salvation really look like in the Old Testament? You ever ponder that? You ever wonder about that? I suppose it's probably a question that many of us wrestle with as we better try to understand the meaning of even the book of Hebrews and even this faith chapter, especially when we compare it to the characters of the Old Testament. In my study Bible that I use a lot at home for sermon and teaching preparation, I love this Bible. I really enjoy it. I came across an article that was written by one Paige Patterson. I really don't know anything about the author, but I do appreciate the article. And I thought I would read it this morning to help us kind of better understand maybe the question of what did salvation look like in the Old Testament. The article is simply titled, Salvation in the Old Testament. I'm going to be sharing some scriptures along with this then. He just gives the references, so I'm going to be sharing a few of these scriptures as well as we come to them. And I read. It's a fairly lengthy article here, or reading. The concept of salvation in the Old Testament features a variety of applications, including deliverance, rescue, safety, and even welfare. In Exodus 14:30, the Lord saved Israel from the hand of the Egyptians. This usage of the term is typical of the times when salvation focuses on physical deliverance from a specific danger. Another nuance involves forensic or legal rescue, which is observed in passages like Deuteronomy 23:27, where a woman who is the subject of sexual attack in a field has no one to rescue her. But the most significant use of the concept, and the one most commonly perceived, is the soteriological emphasis in which the fallen spiritual nature of humankind stands in need of salvation or redemption by God. Soteriological simply means, someone know what that means? James, you know what that means? Yeah, soteriological. The doctrine of salvation, very good. I figured you might know. So it's the reference of the doctrine of salvation. Implicit in all uses of salvation are the perceptions of need and even inability. As often as not, God is featured as the only one who can effect a rescue or bring salvation, which is especially true of the eternal salvation of the individual. Passages such as Isaiah 51:8, which says, "For the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool, but my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation," contrast the ephemeral nature of physical realities with a salvation that is for all generations. And ephemeral simply means lasting for a very short time. Okay? In the famous passage magnifying the beauty of those who bring good news and proclaim salvation, the rescue in view seems to be spiritual and eternal, as given in Isaiah 52, verse 7, where it says, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, Thy God reigneth." Isaiah 59:17 employs language later invoked by New Testament authors such as Paul, who speaks of breastplate of righteousness and the helmet of salvation in Ephesians 6:14 through 17. In Jonah's prayer from the belly of the great fish, he declares that salvation is of the Lord in Jonah 2:9, where it says, "But I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord." While it could be argued that the prophet's thought is only about his abysmal physical circumstance, most would see a more profound avowal anticipating God's sovereign redemption of the soul. Salvation in the Old Testament is also linked with other concepts such as redemption, atonement, and righteousness. Such ideas express the means of salvation or atonement, the goal of salvation or righteousness, or the nature of salvation or redemption. For example, the Passover was designed not only to depict the Exodus from Egypt, but also to remind the Israelites of the more profound significance of the role of sacrifice in salvation. A lamb dies, and its blood is sprinkled on the doorpost so that the death angel will pass over, sparing the life of the firstborn, as we see in the account in Exodus 12:1 through 14. The rituals associated with the Day of Atonement also focused on a vicarious substitutionary atonement for the sins of the people in Leviticus 16:1 through 34. Isaiah 53 conveys the message of a sacrificial act on the part of the suffering servant who made his life an offering for sin that would justify many. "By his stripes we are healed, and the iniquity of us all was laid on him, as he was struck by God for the transgression of us all." God is the sole author of salvation. Here's the piece that we want to get today in view of our text. God is the sole author of salvation, or rather, to answer the question that we might ask at times, what did salvation look like in the Old Testament? God is the sole author of salvation. The human family, horribly marred by sin, cannot effect salvation even by the keeping of the law. This raises the question of how salvation is appropriated in the Old Testament. Genesis 15:6 says, "And he believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness." Declares that Abraham believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. Paul makes this passage central to his whole argument in Romans chapters 1 through 8. "For what saith the Scripture? Abraham believed God, and it was counted unto him for righteousness." In Romans 4:3. While there seemed to be general recognition among Christians that righteousness and holiness are required to stand before God, many erroneously believe that salvation was attained in the Old Testament by the keeping of the law. Both Genesis and Romans agree in declaring that salvation may be attained only through faith or believing in God, as the sacrificial system perpetually illustrated. Atonement must be made. Isaiah 53 presented the suffering servant as the one who would ultimately make that atonement. Paul demonstrates explicitly what is always implicit in the Old Testament. The law could save no one. Salvation is extended in an era on the basis of God's grace appropriated by the faith of human beings. And reading in this helps us to understand that all men, whether Old or New Testament situations era, the Old or New Testament era, were definitely in need of salvation that could only come as given by God. It was not something they did. It was still an offering from God. The system may have been different in the Old Testament, but it was still an obedience walk to Him. So unless you walked out your obedience, walked out your faith and obedience to God, you weren't saved. So it was still about serving God. The New Testament is even more so in the fact that Christ came, died for us, and is our salvation. Perhaps the purpose of this approach with listing all the heroes of the faith in the chapter we have today helps us understand that there is one basic foundation, fundamental truth, that all men must come to understand in order to experience the salvation that we just talked about, that we see in both Old and New. You see, there is something universal that I notice as we read through this chapter, as we look at the individual commitments of each person that's listed. Let's just for a little while spend some time looking at and talking about what we can see in each of these examples that are given in our text. So we're not going to spend a lot of time, just make quick points about each one. Abel, in verse 4, was obedient to God and offered a blood sacrifice in contrast to Cain bringing an offering from the fruit of the earth. Already God had established the fact that atonement had to be made through through the death of an animal, through the shedding of blood. Abel was willing to obey that. Cain did not. Therefore, Cain went down in the spiritual hall of fame as one that was obedient. Verse 5, Enoch. All that I could find about Enoch is that he walked with God. In the book of Jude, it says in verse 14, Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000 of his saints. And then in Genesis 5:21, Enoch lived 65 years and begat Methuselah. Verse 22, and Enoch walked with God after he begat Methuselah 300 years and begat sons and daughters. I believe it is not doing injustice to say, in his walk with God, he was obedient to God. Then in verse 7, with Noah, in spite of all the ridicule and mockery, Noah obeyed God and built what seemed the most ridiculous thing, an ark, a huge ark, when there was no water around. And it was to the saving of his life and his family. Abraham, in verses 8 through 12, was obedient and moved to a foreign land that he later inherited. In the middle of this, in the middle of the story about Abraham, we have Sarah in verse 11, who was obedient to God and accepted a call in her life of something that seemed impossible. Abraham in verse 17 was obedient to God and offered his only son as a sacrifice, believing that God would raise him back to life because of the promise that God had given him. Isaac, in verse 20, was obedient to God and blessed his sons in the order that God had established, not giving in to the cultural norms of the day. Jacob, in verse 21, was obedient and blessed the sons of Joseph. Joseph, in verse 22, was obedient to God when all the odds were against him, and even at his death gave specific direction on what to do with his remains. Moses' parents, in verse 23, were obedient to God and hid their son in spite of the king's commandment. California, they said, you can't sing in church anymore. Are we willing to obey those kinds of orders when they come down the pike, or are we going to go against the king's edicts? Moses, in verses 24 through 29, considering what he had coming as an heir to the throne and a life of luxury, opted rather to be obedient to God and become, in a sense, the deliverer of God's people from slavery. And although not mentioned by name in the text, Joshua in verse 30 was obedient to God and led the people in conquering the city of Jericho, and the walls came crumbling down. In that story, we have Rahab in verse 31. Although she had a terrible reputation, she walked in obedience to God and protected the spies when they needed a safe place to stay and escape from. And then we go on in verse 32 and see that there were many others that could have been individually mentioned for their faithfulness to God, but the writer lumps them all together in order to help us see that there are many, many, many examples of faith and obedience in the Old Testament. I believe these examples help the Hebrew people that this letter was written to better understand that they had a huge advantage in that they were not living in the dispensation of grace through faith in Jesus Christ. And it's that way for us as well. Did you ever think about how much man is drawn to the idea of heroes in our lives? I think we all do it. We idolize sports figures and build halls of fame to them. We build presidential libraries and palaces for kings. We exalt powerful evangelists, speakers, and musicians, and talk glowingly about the success of wealthy people. That kind of list could get very long, but in these last few verses of this chapter, we are shown what really matters when it comes to following true heroes. And I thought I would just spend a little bit of time on this. And then I'd like to, we're already out of time, I'd like to just recap this portion of script, this chapter. Listen to these words again. And we don't even have the accounts of these necessarily. I don't even know what all the writer of Hebrews is referencing here. Because we don't read that much that I'm aware of in the Old Testament about persecution against God's people. I mean, yes, they were slaves and so forth at times, but the kind of persecution that's described here, we don't read about that very much in the Old Testament. Verse 33, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawed in half, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. Of whom the world was not worthy. In parentheses. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. So are these the kinds of heroes we should follow or look up to today? These were ordinary people called to extraordinary callings. So I was studying yesterday, was asking myself the question, if we focused half as much time and energy on becoming like the heroes mentioned in our text today, instead of trying to model our lives after the world's standards of heroes, the church and our communities would look a lot different than what we see today. You believe that? Just ponder that. If we spend half as much time striving to become like these heroes of faith, instead of modeling ourselves after the pattern of the world, giving into the cultural norms of our day, thinking that The pursuit of all these things that we set up as important things to run after. We look to our heroes and say we want to be like them. But if we followed after what we see here in our script, in our text today, our communities, our families, our churches would be completely different. So back again to why I looked at each one of those things very briefly. We look at each one of these individual accounts mentioned in this text. There is one central theme that emerges that is so critical for us to get a hold of. Can someone tell me what it is? Faith comes from what? I said it over and over in every one of these accounts. Obedience, thank you. You cannot have faith without obedience. Every single one of these accounts, it says, by faith he accomplished because he was told by God to do such and such. So to summarize that point, faith is rooted in a walk of obedience. We notice something here that I had never thought about before. This is just a little side note I want you to think about. Adam and Eve are not mentioned in this list of faithful heroes. God created them to walk in perfect obedience to Him, but when they violated that one simple command about not eating from that one tree, it put a separation between them and God. I don't know if there's anything significant to this observation, but it seems a bit interesting to me that Abel is mentioned, but Adam and Eve are not. Is it possible? I just bring this out to make the point about obedience. Is it possible that their disobedience is the reason they aren't listed? I'm not sure that is a very consistent argument when you think about the inconsistencies of many of the heroes of faith that are listed in this list. Moses didn't obey and he struck the rock instead of speaking, and Abraham had a pretty raunchy past, and David and many of the others, pretty drastic deviations away from God's call in their lives. So I'm not sure that we could hold a consistent argument that that's the point that I'm making here, but it is something for you to ponder. And I just throw it out there for what it's worth. So to summarize this chapter, I think we could break it down into three main sections. First, we have the description of faith that we see, where we see faith is the evidence of things not seen, as we saw in the first three verses. Secondly, we have the examples list. This is something that we see throughout this section that the author is trying to make a point with. For example, over and over we read, by faith so-and-so did this. The phrase by faith gets repeated many times in the beginning of each new line. This is intended to drive the idea into the reader's mind. By the end of the chapter, we are saying, okay, so we're supposed to live by faith, apparently. The author does a beautiful thing here by using the stories of this list of heroes in order to recap the Old Testament story in a short, easily readable form with a focus on what faith looks like in real practice. The third section is, we see that not all of these heroes of faith received what was promised while they were alive, but they are still our examples to look to. They are the ones that we look to define what faithful living looks like. But they didn't receive what they were hoping for, at least not in their lifetime. But the author tells us that that's okay. because God has something in store for them in the future. So, what can we learn from this chapter? There are two primary points that I would like to I'd like for you to consider. Number one, it seemed like maybe this chapter is trying to help us understand that faith is not or cannot be necessarily exactly defined. In fact, I'm not aware that there is anywhere in the Bible that faith is or can be precisely defined for us. And perhaps that's the reason why there are so many different opinions of what faith is, or even how it works, or what it does for us. In understanding that, it helps us to appreciate what the author may be trying to do for us by giving us all these different examples of faith and what it looks like through these different individuals. So practically, as we consider this reality, it helps us to understand that we need these kinds of examples of how faith is lived out as we read these biblical stories, as well as stories of perhaps more modern-day heroes of faith. I think that's probably one reason why I'm drawn to following the stories of the persecuted church. I would like to just note that those kinds of stories are all around us. And we can learn from them if we're willing to listen to them and to share them. I believe with all of my heart, every one of you has a story to tell. And if that story is rooted in an obedient walk of growth and faith, it's a story worth repeating. It's a story worth telling. I don't have much of a story. I don't know what I would say. Have an encounter with Jesus, and you'll have a story to tell. So as I think about this, when Leon and Rachel shared their testimony here a couple weeks ago, he mentioned to me, it doesn't quite seem fair. Now you know our story, but we don't know yours. So how about we have them over and sit down and tell them our stories? And how about we do that for each other? And how about we listen to other people's stories and what faith has done for them? Number two, even these heroes of the faith didn't see what was promised in this life. In fact, we read in these verses, 33 through 38, what happened to many of those people, which included a lot of severe persecution. In spite of that, they were commended for their faith, even though they didn't see many of the blessings that they would have wanted to see in this earth, on this earth while they were here. What do we take away from this? We should not always expect for things to go well for us. And when they don't, we shouldn't or can't turn our back on God. Too many of us are expecting God to judge our faith by the outcome of our circumstances rather than by our faithfulness. Did you get that? Too many of us are looking for God to judge our faith by the outcome of our circumstances rather than by our faithfulness. So in view of this truth, I think it would be good to sound the warning once more. I talked about this in an earlier message. Be good to sound the warning once more that there are many people out there that will tell you that faith can be manipulated to the point of getting what you want, including wealth, health, and an overall smooth sailing lifestyle. This belief, brothers and sisters, is so contrary to the examples that we're given in our text today. The real truth to grasp a hold of is to understand that difficult things will come, But we must cling firmly to the hand of faith in a God that will not judge us by our successes, but by whether we have been faithful in walking in obedience to Him. I think it's safe to say that there are people who say that they preach Jesus, but in reality they don't. It is the gospel of a false God. Please understand, God is totally in the business of restoring the brokenness in our lives and in this world where people allow Him to do that. But sometimes God lets the most faithful people go through suffering and hardship on this earth, as we see in these last verses of this text. And I'd just like to encourage you, if that's you right now, we can't promise that God will step in and bring healing and deliverance from your situation, but one thing we know, He's calling you to a life of faithfulness. And if you're walking in that place of faith, the Creator of the world is standing beside you and is giving you applause. Just like He did in this list of heroes of faith. In the end of all the suffering, we can then expect to stand beside the risen King of glory and hear these most beautiful words. Well done, my servant. Enter into the joy of the Lord. I close with that.